Hi, my name is Michael Creamer, and welcome to a podcast focused on the world of corporate real estate and everything that touches and surrounds it. And in today's world, sustainability is absolutely something that everyone needs to be engaged with, understand, because it affects every aspect of the property world. Today, I'm talking to two experts. Firstly, Oliver Dudok Van Heel, who is Head of Client Sustainability Environment at Freshfields, and Katie Henry, who's a Sustainability Manager at Cushman & Wakefield, dedicated to the Microsoft account. So, Oliver and Katie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Good to have you both. I thought what we'd do is maybe just start with what I call the sustainability story over the last couple of years. And I say that because when I come across sustainability, it seems to me that we're almost at a crossroads with businesses. And by that, I mean more and more seem to be embracing sustainability, ESG, triple bottom line, whatever we might want to call it. And maybe we'll get into some of that. And we're really at a cusp where businesses are taking it more and more seriously and seeing it more central to their business rather than something at the periphery. So firstly, Oliver, does that resonate with you? Do you think that's what's happening? Maybe we can talk about it at a sort of corporate level to start with.
Absolutely. Yeah, delighted to. Yes, it does resonate. You know, I mean, I've been working in sustainability since the year 2000. And whilst, you know, and it's a fantastic area to work in, but it can also be extremely frustrating where you're seeing, you know, one step forward, two steps back, and never quite seeing the kind of momentum that you're hoping for. And for me, that changed around 2017. And the main driver for that change, I think, was a change within the financial services industry, particularly the asset management industry, that suddenly started, and I'm talking here about mainstream asset managers, we suddenly started to ask questions about the companies that they were investing in that related to material ESG issues, things like climate change, things like resource scarcity, things like human rights. Why? Not because they were interested in, you know, saving the planet, but much more because they realized that those were drivers of significant value. Now, that didn't come out of nowhere. That shift came because there were a few things that happened before then. One of those things is the Paris Climate Agreement, which was signed in 2015, which, you know, created a framework that would drive policy and regulation towards climate action. The other is the establishment of the Sustainable Development Goals by the UN, also in 2015, and a big campaign around that. And of course, the Sustainable Development Goals, or the SDGs, were very much seen as a framework that even business could relate to, because there were a lot of opportunities in achieving the 17 SDGs. There were a lot of business opportunities there. The mindset of business policy started to change. In parallel to that, you also had a change in societal expectations. People started to realize that actually things weren't quite right and were expecting different things from the companies they work with and the governments that they lived under. And I think all those things come together made the investor community realize this is something we need to pay attention to. And that for me is where the real shift started, 2017, and it's accelerated since.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And the property world is perhaps a couple of steps behind that, but obviously some of that relates very much to investor demand. Katie, if we flip it over to you, can you talk a little bit about, you know, the parallels to that in the property industry? Are you seeing that same sort of change beginning to happen or accelerating?
Yes, so, and maybe not to quite the same extent as along other lines of business, but there has been a shift, and, you know, large multinationals have been working on sustainability programs for a number of years, and now we're moving towards greater consideration of the buildings that they occupy and what impact they have. Businesses have obviously been signing up to science-based targets, more recently announcing, you know, their net zero ambitions, and they're now looking at what are their impacts across all areas of their business, including the supply chain. And with regards to occupier space, some companies are starting to ask the questions about the sustainability of those buildings that they're in, looking at BREEAM and LEED certifications, and in some cases, green leases are being used. There's much room for this to increase, particularly given the large amount of carbon that real estate is responsible for. And I think in a post-COVID world, health and wellbeing will also be a greater consideration for occupiers, meaning that they'll be considering things like indoor air quality, the green spaces and other amenities that are attractive to employees. In terms of Microsoft, they've been setting the bar high and as a business have committed to beyond net zero to be carbon negative by 2030. And this means addressing their impact across their entire supply chain. With regards to its occupier space, Microsoft is aiming to reduce the impact of its global portfolio and have set some really kind of strict targets around how they construct new buildings, and sustainability is considered at the very core of that. You know, they look at LEED construction standards and try to certify some of their big campus sites to zero waste, as two examples. And also with regards to their other existing portfolios, they look at the sustainability of relocations and office refits, looking at LED lighting, how all of their HVAC systems are being used and so on. And all their other occupied sites are expected to work towards a minimum operating sustainability standard, but also to go above and beyond where possible.
So does that, maybe just making the connection back to what you were talking about, Oliver, is that, you know, from an investor point of view, you're talking about the wider picture. Is that, if you like, the response of Microsoft, do you think that's to investor demand and this whole change that has been happening since 2015?
I think that's one of the drivers. I have to say that Microsoft has always, well, certainly in the last decade, been at the forefront of this. I think they go beyond investor expectations. They go beyond regulatory requirements. But it's certainly driving, you know, a big shift in generally the perception of property. And of course, some of this is also, it's not just driven by investors, and not just driven by regulation. It's also driven by cost considerations. Because if you're able to operate a building at a lower cost, because you're using less energy, then of course that, you know, everybody wins. Similarly, if you're producing reduced waste streams, your cost of operating the business will go down. And then we can talk even about the construction part of it, where, you know, and I think this is still a little bit into the future, and you are the experts on this topic. But, you know, to me, there's a sense of, you know, what's the value, and I mean here the economic value, of reusing materials in order to construct new buildings. Is there a saving to be achieved there? Because of course the environmental saving is significant if we're able to do that.
And how is Freshfields looked at that? We talked a little bit before about your recent, I guess, move in London, and maybe you can discuss that a little bit. It sounds like it's an exemplar of what businesses can and should be doing.
Yes, I mean, it certainly was a very interesting development, because we have, and Katie will know this well from the time we worked together, we did put together in the past kind of briefings for how, when one of our offices considered, or one of our offices considered moving to a different location, you know, what they should consider in terms of both the moving itself, but the choice of location and things like that. And at the time, it was taken as a thank you, very interesting, let's see if we can use this. But not necessarily a big driver. And I think when we moved from Fleet Street to 100 Bishopsgate, which happened late last year, it was a very different proposition. There was, you know, this whole idea of it being sustainable, fit for the future, was front and center of a lot of what we were trying to do. So yes, we looked for buildings that had the top BREEAM certifications. We negotiated in partnership with the other tenants of the building to ensure that we had a green electricity throughout. Our fit out was SCAR gold rated. We've got rid of all the localized waste bins. We've got significant different ways of achieving that. And what was interesting at that, it was no longer us in the sustainability team trying to push that. It was us kind of giving a little bit of a steer, and the people responsible for the move saying, okay, we understand that this is needed now. Let's see what's the best we can do. And the other thing I would add, which was, I think, you know, which I really appreciated, is that none of the goods that were in the old building were thrown away. So whilst we didn't move everything over to our new offices, everything that was there in the old office, it has been reused in one way or another. In some cases, it's providing chairs to people working from home. In other cases, donating them to an organization called Business to School, so that they effectively took everything that we didn't want and found a way to donate them to school, going from, you know, executive boardroom tables to single pens. And I think to be able to do that, and to be able to have that promise to say we're not going to throw anything away in this move, I think was a very, very important consideration.
Yeah, I think that's a really powerful kind of message almost, and that idea of the circular economy. If you sit down and think about what you can do other than throw things away, which I guess is the easy option potentially, but not the right option. Katie, is that something that you see other corporates mirroring in terms of the circular economy or reusing things when they move?
Well, a number of companies have been, at the very least, finding new homes for their existing furniture and equipment, and even capturing this data in terms of its benefit to communities where they can. But the extent to which companies are doing this is probably a bit unclear. And I think, you know, it might just be a case that there's a lot of businesses repurposing or reusing furniture and IT equipment. But, you know, what about the carpet tiles, the stationery and so on? And I know of a few suppliers of those things that have great programs that help you to reuse and redistribute your equipment. So I think the question is really, how circular are companies really being? And I don't think that is happening yet.
Okay. And maybe just switch directions a little bit, or at least a different thought. I mean, I certainly know from a Cushman point of view, we're being asked and challenged by our clients to uphold the Paris Accord. We've got COP26 coming up this year. So if I throw this back to you, Oliver, maybe we could just talk about what might come out of that. And let me just, for everyone listening, you can correct me if I get this wrong, but COP stands for the Conference of All Parties. And there's been various ones going on. I guess the Paris Accord was 2015, where the various world leaders negotiated a treaty or an agreement that says we need to keep climate warming below 2%. And I think a lot of people quote 1.5%. I've certainly seen and heard from clients saying, what are you doing about that as a business? So that's got nothing to do with the property side of things so much as to what it does, but also everything else that companies are doing and with their supply chains. I guess, having said all of that, the question is, am I basically right in saying that's how some of this is being spread across businesses? If businesses asking other businesses to effectively sign up or conform to this? And what do you expect to see happening this year in Glasgow, I believe it is, at COP26?
Yes, I think the Paris Agreement provides a very significant backdrop to anything that we talk about in relation to climate change. Because it is effectively an implicit, it's a promise between the countries of the world to do something about climate change, but it's a promise that has to be carried out through regulation. And therefore, it becomes a kind of threat to those operating within that regulatory environment to ensure that they are ready for whatever regulation comes out of that. Now, it's not just regulation. It's also things like subsidies, financial support for clean technologies, etc. But let's stick to the regulation piece, because I think a lot of this is driven by risk mitigation considerations. So that is why investors, for instance, became interested, because they realized that actually, if this is going to become a law that curtails companies willy-nilly emitting carbon as they want to, then they have to be prepared for those changes. And if they're going to invest in an asset, they want to make sure that asset is ready for those changes. So in that way, it is that backdrop of kind of threat of regulation and policy action that drives a lot of this. Now, COP21, so the Paris Agreement was, of course, a highlight. Since then, things have not been as successful. There was a COP last year that was due to take place in South America, ended up because of problems in Chile to be moved to Madrid. But the reality is that it wasn't a success. One of the big drivers for the fact that it wasn't a success was, of course, that Donald Trump had made it very clear that the US was going to leave the Paris Climate Agreement. Things have now changed. And I think even before that, irrespective of the attitude of the US, there was a significant sense that, you know, whatever is happening in the US, everyone else needs to stay on the agenda. And that included China, who's made some, you know, they've made some statements about wanting to be zero carbon by 2060. Now, most other countries have committed to 2050, but still, coming from China, which is a country that still has a lot of energy generated from coal, that was a significant announcement. So we're seeing a shift in what countries are doing, and given that there is now a license from the business community, partly driven by investors, but partly also by what the business community itself is doing, see the example of Microsoft, and partly also because we've had in the last few years a very significant shift in consumer perception. And I'm talking about here about things like the Greta effect and the David Attenborough effect that have raised the awareness of what is being done to the planet to a level of kind of wider consciousness that really didn't exist before. So all those things together really point to COP26 as being, we all hope, the conference that will cement a lot of the stuff that was agreed in Paris. Now, add to that Joe Biden's new presidency, and one of the first things he did in office was rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement. And of course, then you have kind of a perfect mix of all the right political momentum, business momentum, and citizen momentum to say, you know, something needs to happen in Glasgow. And I'm pleased to say that the UK government is really putting a lot of effort into this. I mean, I was speaking recently to one of the people who was at the very beginning working for the Cabinet Office on providing, you know, what would COP26 look like and how would the UK do this? And they wrote the document that suggested that Glasgow become the host for this, and they won this. And at the time, it was him and one other person working on this. There are now, you know, hundreds of people within the government working on making COP26 a success. So I think there's real genuine momentum, and I think we're all very hopeful that it will lead to proper action.
Yeah, as you said, let's hope so. It'll be fascinating to see in this new world order, as you say, with Joe Biden in the White House, that things can hopefully get back on target. And it's interesting you say that since Paris, not much has happened yet. And I guess maybe switching to you, Katie, I mean, it seems to me in the last year and a half, and particularly, or maybe exacerbated, accelerated by COVID, there's been this switch from the corporate top-down approach to this, which both you and Oliver have talked about quite a lot, in terms of, and some of its governmental regulation, some of its corporations wanting to do what they think the right thing is. But now we seem to have this groundswell of individuals saying, you know what, this is super important, and I don't want to be working at businesses that don't understand or take this seriously. I want to work for companies that are doing something. I want to do something personally. If we put that into the sort of the corporate real estate world, are you seeing people within different companies pushing the sustainability agenda, if you follow how I'm going, rather than just doing what they should be doing because their company's told them that's what they're doing?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I have seen in the last, you know, couple of years compared to the beginning of my career, employees coming to me and saying, what are we doing about X, Y, and Z? You know, why am I still finding that, you know, dishwashers are running constantly in this particular building and they're not full? Why, you know, they're taking notice of things. And I think, you know, for a long time, I felt frustrated that perhaps the people around me didn't seem to show an interest in this subject so much, and maybe they kind of had less insight into the reasons as why it was so important. And to Oliver's point, you know, people like David Attenborough and Greta Thunberg, you know, they have just really brought this to the front of people's minds. And I think there's been a real shift as well in kind of listening to people, listening to each other, you know, in a slightly different vein, you know, around things like mental health. You know, we listen to each other much more now. And I think businesses are listening to their employees more. But, you know, if we don't go down this path, there's, you know, risks of employees moving to other businesses to work elsewhere because they'll want to work for a company that stands for the right things and is, you know, behaving accordingly. And, you know, I remember years back saying that if, you know, advising businesses, if you don't do this, you're going to lose business as a potential competitive loss inside of, associated with not being kind of sustainable. But I think now we're starting to hear that bids and kind of client work can be lost in the same way. You know, it's now becoming obvious to everyone that this has kind of a big role to play in a whole company, a whole business.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting. It's almost like we're getting up a really good kind of head of steam from every direction, be it government legislation, be it corporates wanting and being seen to do the right thing, from customers, consumers, employees saying we have to do this, otherwise, you know, we're not going to want to work here. I guess maybe to think about a couple of things sort of into the future and to wrap up, and maybe I'll start with you, Katie. I've heard more over the last 12 months this term stranded assets, i.e. buildings that if they don't adapt or adopt some of the stuff that we've been talking about, we'll see a decrease in occupancy, rental value, yield, and so on. Is that a real issue? Or are buildings, by and large, able to be kind of reformatted so they meet these criteria?
Well, it absolutely is a real issue. They can be reformatted, but the real estate sector is under increasing pressure to adapt and mitigate its impact. You know, it has both transitional and physical climate-related risks related to things like the location and characteristics of an asset. But over the next few years, buildings are at risk of devaluing if they don't keep up to date with energy regulation. You know, in countries like the UK and the US, you know, if buildings fail to meet certain energy efficiency ratings, they won't be able to be rented out to tenants and leaving them stranded, as it's described. But, you know, there is absolutely an ability to retrofit buildings and improve their efficiencies in the long run.
Great. And Oliver, maybe give the last word, so to say, to you. What's your kind of, I guess, either view or what you want to see happen over the next, you know, 2 to 5 years in this space that you think will make a difference? Are we building up this head of steam so we just need to keep going, or are there other things that are going to come into play?
Well, I think the direction that we're going and the speed at which we're going is finally kind of matching the need for action. And that's the bit that, you know, over the years I've said, you know, it can be a frustrating job because you were seeing change, but that change was too slow compared to what was really needed. Now we're seeing a shift in that. Things are changing at much greater speed. There is a word of caution to go with that, though, which is that I don't know, none of us know really, whether it's too little too late. Because, you know, when we talk about climate change, there comes a time when, you know, some of what are called positive feedback loops that become reinforcing. So certain warming generates a certain kind of activity in the earth, such as, for instance, the release of methane, and that release of methane exacerbates the warming, and suddenly the warming becomes out of our control. We don't know whether, you know, given the carbon that is already in here, and the fact that the carbon that's in the atmosphere will continue warming the planet for decades to come, whether it's too little too late. But let's assume and be positive and assume that it's not. Then I suspect, well, climate action will continue. And given that, you know, we're getting to a place now where the cost of energy is lower, or at least at a par for renewables in most instances than it is for fossil fuels, that's going to continue. One thing we do need to be careful of is to not put all of our energy into climate change reduction and forget about some of the other challenges. Because, for instance, you know, if we significantly impact our natural ecosystems, talking here about rainforests, about, you know, the natural world around us, and because we need to, you know, we need resources, we need land, we need urban development, etc., then that will have an impact on climate on the one hand, but also will have significant impact on our ecosystems and the balance of those ecosystems. And we are dependent on a well-balanced ecosystem for the survival of ours and many other species. So I think that, you know, we must make sure that we balance climate action with a lot of other things. And then the other thing that's really coming to the fore now is a lot more awareness and action on the social side of sustainability. I think part of this has existed for many years. You know, we've had concerns around human rights. We've had some really interesting, good developments to ensure that human rights are better managed in supply chains. For instance, in the UK, you have the Modern Slavery Act. In France, you have the Duty of Vigilance, which places the onus on organizations to ensure that their supply chains are as sustainable as possible. I mean, that's mainly from a human rights and modern slavery perspective. So that's, you know, an important driver that's going to continue. Then you have, as a result of Black Lives Matter movement, finally here to stay, a shift in the perception of the importance of diversity, not just as a kind of the right thing to do, but also as a source of innovation and creative thinking within organizations. And finally, also as a way to ensure social stability within our world. So all those things are pointing in a positive direction. The big unknown to a lot of this for the next, you know, few years is what will the impact of COVID, and I mean here mainly the economic impact of COVID, be? Now, there are some positive signs. You know, we're seeing many governments put together COVID recovery programs that actually emphasize the importance of sustainability. So, for instance, the EU's recovery package, a very significant financial package, places a a lot of emphasis on digitization on the one hand and sustainability on the other. So that enables that funding to go towards the kind of technologies, the kind of developments that really will take us to a more sustainable society. There are some positive signs, but of course, you know, we're still in the middle of this thing. The economic impacts are still being felt, in fact, are still, you know, very real. And how we recover from that and what will be possible as a result of the economic crisis, as a result from COVID, is a question mark. But on the whole, I am certainly more optimistic than I've been in the past in my career. I think this is an exciting time to be working in sustainability.
Great. And I think, yeah, that hopefully we're at a positive inflection point, as you say, and with all the different pieces of the puzzle coming together, we can continue to make strides in terms of reducing temperature and dealing with climate change and all those other things that you just alluded to. And of course, they're all interconnected. Fascinating conversation, both you, Katie, and Oliver. Thank you very much. I think we're going to wrap it up there. And then hopefully in 6 or 12 months' time, we'll do this again and you'll be even more positive. But thank you again for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.